Thanks, Chairperson, and good morning. And good morning, honorable members, my colleagues, our principals from the Department of Human Settlements. Chairperson, I'm going to basically do the opening remarks. The main presentation will be done by our research manager, Adrian DiLolo, who's sitting next to me. He's also supported by our research, the research manager on this particular project, Mr. Andreas Bertoldi. And we also have in our midst Eugene Perumal, who is the program manager at the Social Housing Foundation. And from the department, I see the DDG, Mr. Dabandu, and the chief, acting chief director, Mr. Mkomezulu. I think that then comprises our delegation, Chairperson. If I could go ahead. Our computer is a bit slow. The purpose of the research, one, is to inform the public discussion around rental housing issues in South Africa with quality and reliable data. And we felt that it is our responsibility to look for that. Secondly, is to provide policy-making forums such as yourselves and processes with the best possible information on rental housing matters. And thirdly, is to provide the social housing institutions and other rental housing providers or players with the information.
So what you try to do is adjust it for a child and for an adult. It's the same thing with the transmission network. You're adjusting the slide so that you don't go unstable. You deliver just enough to meet the demand, and you've got to keep adjusting it. And that's what we call, we use what we call reactive power devices to adjust that slope so that it's always at the right level. And that's another challenge, because you have to now deal with bringing on the power stations as well as bringing on various devices in your transmission network. So that's one of the challenges that we meet in winter. And the colder it gets, the more steep the challenge. The other challenge that we faced, and I'll quickly point out a few. This is our 11, at that time it was 11 power stations. How they started winter and ended winter in terms of their stockpile days. And I want to focus on three stations particularly. The one is Majuba Power Station, which went from 41 days to 23 days. The second is Tutuka Power Station. Make sure I've got the color here. Went from 25 days to 14 days. Why I point those two power stations out is those are the two power stations which require extensive coal transport. The mines are not at the power station. You need to bring in coal from other sources. And so what happens is over winter, we need to make sure we have enough coal before we start winter and enough coal during winter that we deliver to keep up with the projection. And even then, it can be a challenge to maintain. But what also is a challenge, you'll see this power station at the bottom, Arnold Power Station, that went from 30 days to 10. What happens sometimes is if there's a problem at one of the mine supplies...
There's been an apparent increase in evictions from private rental housing, and we're looking at what kind of interventions can be made to address the issue. And now what we have is the cost-benefit analysis of RDP housing and social rental housing, and the full presentation is going to follow. I must at this stage say, Chairperson, that is going to be at a high level for two reasons. One is that we have a full report on a disc, which we'll have to live with yourselves. And secondly, we're hoping to launch this research in the second week of September, where a more in-depth discussion will take place. So really what we are saying is that we have been doing research as the Social Housing Foundation, but we should not just be a policy think tank. These outcomes need to be moved forward to inform your discussions, to inform policy decisions. So really, in the coming months, is to strategize around how this can be implemented. And finally, that's what we are hoping to achieve from today, for taking your time, Chairperson, that we hope that you will be better informed on key rental housing issues as identified through the research, and that such information will be used by the committee in your policy deliberations, when you discuss budgets, and when you perform your oversight functions. We hope that we would be able to establish a mutually beneficial ongoing dialogue which will help facilitate moving some of the research outcomes forward. And I think that is the end of my introduction, Chairperson. I will now hand over to our research manager, Idrin Dilolo, to give the full presentation. I'm also made aware, Chairperson, that it is really cold.
Mr. Mahalo, for the introduction, and thank you especially to Chairperson Dambuzo for having us here today, and for the opportunity of presenting you some of the outcomes of what has been perhaps the most significant piece of research, of our many pieces of research, perhaps our most groundbreaking and significant piece of research in the last year, our cost-benefit analysis of RDP housing and social housing. As Brian mentioned, my name is Idrin Dilolo, and I am, for want of a better term, the research manager or research workflow manager at the Social Housing Foundation. I would also like to recognize Hafi Bendagajela, who is our technical assistance workflow manager. Is that the right term? Who has entered the room. Very, very briefly, and quick oversight, there's always been, and committee members know better than I do even, there's always been a great deal of focus around housing programs on the budgetary implications. How much does it cost? How much does this intervention cost? What does this intervention cost? What are the outcomes? Well, we all know what the subsidies are, but what we set out to do in this study is to look at the real costs, the hidden costs of both RDP housing and social housing. We looked at firstly the hidden fiscal costs, the costs that go beyond the subsidy. But perhaps more importantly, we looked at what are the secondary broader economic impacts, what are the broader economic returns on that investment and ongoing costs to government and society. We wanted a much better look, a much deeper understanding of what RDP really costs as compared to what social housing really costs, both in the immediate fiscal terms and in the broader long-term economic impact on both programs. So this was really perhaps the first study of its kind done in South Africa on these particular housing programs, and we've had some very interesting results. So like I mentioned, the study compared the full range of costs and benefits of public investment in those two models, social rental and RDP. So what were the purposes and objectives of our cost-benefit analysis? Most importantly, we wanted to look, as I mentioned, of comparing the overall cost of both models and as well as the broader economic and fiscal implications of both models. The primary objective was to assess the most important direction for government in using scarce resources. And one phrase we used here was the best spend of the last rand. So it all comes back to the most effective use of public resources. That's what we were really concerned about. As such, the CBA focuses on the costs and benefits of the two housing delivery models to society as a whole, rather than necessarily to the individual households. We do look at the individual households as well, but primarily we were concerned with the impact of society as a whole. Secondarily, we wanted to determine and quantify, whenever it was possible, the key economic effects. We wanted to understand the broader social and distributional effects, those effects that are not necessarily immediately evident. And we also wanted to assess the performance of the two housing models against an agreed policy framework. Perhaps before I go any further, I want to just emphasize that while I was the manager of this research, I wasn't the researcher per se, and I just wanted to ask Andreas Bertoldi to come forward for a few moments to give a very brief outline of what a cost-benefit analysis looks like, what kind of research this is. So if you can just give us a brief oversight.
Thank you, Adrian. I think the key thing to note is that, unlike other research, cost-benefit analysis is primarily an economic decision-making tool. So it's really there as one instrument that should help inform policy discussion and decision-making. As such, it is not a financial model. It is not a budgeting tool. It is simply a tool that helps you to assess all relative costs and benefits of a particular project. The perspective that we adopt in the CBA is what we term a welfare economic approach. So our principal concern is for the overall welfare effect on society. So it's irrespective of who incurs the costs or who the benefits accrue to. We do that in what we call a distributional analysis, but our initial starting point is to say, as a society, we have a scarce set of resources, and what is the most optimal allocation of those resources to achieve the maximum outcome given our particular policy objectives. So I think it's really about trying to assess the extent to which a project leads to an increase in general welfare. And I think it's important that we remember that perspective quite importantly. So we're not concerned primarily with individual households, but really from society's perspective, although we do look at individual cost allocations and benefits at a later stage in the study. Secondly, everything is very slow. why is the CBA so important and why do we think it's so valuable in the South African context? And I think the key reason, I think Adrian's already alluded to this, is that the current debate is largely framed around short-term affordability issues in terms of the housing subsidies. So typically we're thinking in terms of 3-year NTA cycles or maybe a 5-year budget. And then we're generally thinking about the scale of the overwhelming housing need. So these two slides aren't in the printed, sorry, in the printed set. My apologies. Sorry, yeah. It's just these two slides that somehow set that got printed. As I was just saying, I think the key thing about the CBA and what it tries to introduce into the debate is the long-term perspective around the costs. Because often we think only about the initial construction costs around particular housing delivery models, and we forget about the fact that housing is around or should be around for a long period, and somebody has to pick up the costs for maintaining that housing, for providing the services, for doing the refurbishment. So the perspective we adopt in the CBA, in this particular model, we've adopted a 40-year life cycle perspective. So we're saying it's not just the cost today, which in fact, if you look at it in the overall picture, is often the smallest amount. So again, in the RDP case, for example, the subsidy is 47,000 Rand. But when we look at the actual cost that has to be incurred to build that house around bulk services, around link services, it's more likely 120,000 Rand. Then on top of that, you've got to add the fact that municipalities have to provide services like water, roads. In many cases, the maintenance cost falls to the municipality. So there are ongoing operating costs, which then make that housing unit over the 40-year life cycle substantially more than that initial subsidy. So what the CBA tries to do is to try to highlight those real costs to society. So we can start comparing the different housing delivery models. Because often the assumption is that the subsidy is the beginning and the end of what the housing cost is, and it's not. So really from a CBA perspective, it's an economic view that tries to assess the cost of housing beyond the initial construction cost and the subsidy cost. And then to look at what the broader implications are for society. So I think, I'm not sure if we had this one in later, Adrian. Okay, I think I should discuss that already. So then that's pretty much the same thing. So it's very slow. Now I'm just going to make one brief comment that, I think as all good researchers, we always like to put in the limitations. Like anything, every tool or instrument has pros and cons. And I think the CBA also has its limitations. And I think, and I just want to highlight them, and they're not necessarily negatives. I'm saying the one is that it's an economic perspective. So it cannot substitute for policy discussion, for decision making, for other criteria that may be applied. It is one perspective that you can apply to an analysis of a project. So there may very well be overriding political concerns or national priorities which would say, well, in fact, yes, the CBA may not be entirely positive in a particular instance, but we have other concerns which should override that. So I'm just saying this doesn't take away the need for discussion, for engagement. So it's a tool that helps us reflect a bit more on the real costs and benefits of a particular delivery model. Secondly, a CBA necessarily simplifies reality. While there's a lot of serious empirical research, or we spent months basically looking at particular projects, collecting data from municipalities, we are also abstracting. So we're making some assumptions around how the world works, what some of the key broader costs and benefits are to society. So we can't quantify every single issue in the level of detail. We'll be here forever. So at some level we have to draw a line in the sand and say we've done the best we can under particular time frames and given the given data. And then that kind of relates to the fact that we necessarily make some assumptions. So in the report, when you look at the particular documents, there are a whole host of areas where the research, both nationally and internationally, is not always clear. So what are the actual effects of housing on people's health outcomes or educational outcomes, access to job opportunities? So there are lots of debates in this particular environment. We've tried to quantify and actually study these. We did an extensive household survey as part of this process. So we've tried to come to some detailed insight into what these causal relationships might be. But nevertheless, there are some assumptions which we've had to build into the CBA model. And then finally, I think, the CBA can't give you a magic number. This is one of the things we often think about when we do economic or financial models, that there's a number that comes out which is the answer. What we can do here are broad indications of what the likely fiscal implications are, what the broad cost parameters are. So it's not necessarily a detailed financial model in the sense that, you would take this to the bank and say, please fund this. This is really about helping you make decisions and inform the policy discussion. I think I'm going to hand back to Adrian.
Madam Chair, I might say this is a remarkable turnout. Does the committee usually have 100% show? I'm not. Okay. Always critical in
this kind of research or any research, that we are clear about definitions. And I'm just going to be very clear here what we mean by RDP housing and by social rental. RDP refers to the housing built under the capital subsidy scheme, both the individual and project-linked subsidies, and it's characterized generally by large-scale housing delivery, usually freestanding and on an individual urban. It's certainly in the vast majority of cases. What we mean by social rental housing is that rental housing built under the institutional and the new social restructuring grant subsidies. Usually, it is medium to high density and delivered on an institutional basis. It has institutional management and is usually managed by a social housing institution. So that's our definitions for the study for clarity. The critical questions for the study were, and I'll just go over these very quickly because we've more or less discussed them. What are the true and medium long-term costs of implementing both of these models, including land acquisition, infrastructure development and administration, and that range of intangible costs and benefits, those secondary effects? What are the key economic effects? And what are the broader social and distributional effects of both of these housing models? And lastly, how do the models perform against this policy framework? When we set out to do this research, this is how we envisaged it. We looked at a layered approach. We thought it critical that we have a financial CBA, that is public revenue. What does it cost? What are the project costs, and what are the revenues generated? The second piece, and this is perhaps I think the most important piece of our cost benefit analysis, and that was our economic CBA. Here we looked at the less evident and less immediate factors of both housing models: the sunk costs, the multipliers. We looked at efficiency pricing, ongoing operating costs, those intangibles such as the human factor and urban density. We also looked at, as Andreas mentioned, we also looked at social CBA as well. We did an extensive household survey, which I'll come to a little later. Andre also mentioned that this kind of research is certainly challenging. One reason is that the intangible elements are often hard to quantify. What really led to this economic development? What really led to these economic opportunities? The long-term effects of rental housing in South Africa are largely untested because this form of rental housing, social rental housing, is a relatively new intervention in South Africa. There are, in fact, some different forms of RDP and rental, and it's hard to find a representative sample. And there's also a very wide range of effects which are difficult to control for. Having recognized these challenges, we moved on, and after a lengthy process, the consortium headed by Rhizome and a CBA expert group in the Netherlands called Rebel Group was selected out of 8 bidders after an exhaustive process. We developed a broad-based steering committee, which included a tremendous amount of input from what was then the National Department of Housing, and a great deal of thanks must go to Dr. Zeleka Sokopa and her team from the department, who were extremely supportive, and a range of other experts, including economists. The SHF team had a great deal of input. We did a lot of active engagements and drafts, and finally, and a final report was delivered in mid-2009. Now that full report, Brian, I believe, is on this disc, which every member will receive. How was the study structured? 4 phases. One, we examined the financial input, and that included looking at the land acquisition costs,
capital expenditure, ongoing maintenance, infrastructure, which was our financial analysis. We looked at economic input. We analysed the primary and secondary effects of both housing models. It analysed cause and effect. We looked at statistical data, and we looked at and we reviewed the opportunity and transaction costs. Thirdly, there was the social and distributional input, the overall results of the CBA. And lastly, perhaps most importantly, because this is the real purpose of the study, we looked at policy input. And I think particularly there, the budgetary analysis impact to Treasury was the most important. We did six case studies, so that was we examined three pairs of projects. The two primary pairs was the RDP in Bram Fisherville and the social housing rental in Roodepoort in Johannesburg. We compared the Potsdam RDP project and the Ammerlinde social housing project in the Eastern Cape. And we also did a supplementary project in Middelburg, and that was Umhluzi and Tokologo and Hope City. Sorry, Umhluzi, Tokologo and Hope City, we compared. How did we select these projects? They had to represent what was a typical RDP, as close to a typical RDP project and a social housing project as we could get. They needed to be in existence for a year or more, so we could really understand the longer term effects. Selection offered a range. We had to look at a whole range of housing projects in relation to location and city size, some variety. And the two that we looked at in each of the three RDPs had to be within the same geographic area and municipal boundaries if we were going to compare them fairly. I would add here that we also did a social survey of 600 households, and we were very careful because these two housing or programs do target somewhat different income groups. Of the hundreds of households we surveyed, we aimed for the lower end of social housing and the higher end of RDP housing. So we tried to sort of get a general, as close as we could in terms of income of both houses, again, for the fairest comparison possible. Now we go to the CBA findings. First and foremost, we find that on a pure financial basis, on a pure fiscal basis, that the overall life cycle financial costs of a social rental housing unit are between 2 to 2.5 times higher than in RDP housing, on a pure fiscal analysis. However, the true capital cost of an RDP unit is at least double the current subsidy. No one anywhere in the country is delivering an RDP house at the cost of the subsidy. We must look at, too, the cost of bulk services, link infrastructure, the cost of land. These are all hidden subsidies. And while we're not pricing for the land, the municipalities are providing for the new RDP projects through their MIG grants, through other programs, and often through their own revenue. There's also a potential loss of revenue of that land, from that land given to RDP. So what we basically found is the real cost of developing an RDP unit, when you look at all these other costs, often carried by municipalities, although MIG is channeled through them from national, is in fact really double the current subsidy. Now, from my first point,
It's important to note that the higher lifestyle fiscal cost of social housing compared to RDP comes from the more central location of social housing, of social rental housing, more expensive land. It's more expensive to acquire the land and build there. Higher building standards. I saw some reports that assessed that approximately 40% of RDP houses had major structural problems. You will find a much, much lower rate in social rental housing. So high building standards does mean an overall more expensive life cycle costs. Better ongoing maintenance and servicing in social rental housing. So these all contribute to a higher life cycle financial cost of RDP housing. It's also worth noticing that because RDP developments are so huge, there are some economic scale efficiency. The projects involve a much number higher number of units, and you do get efficiencies there rather than, say, building a smaller set of flats in social housing. More findings. When the financial lifestyle costs are combined with the wider economic costs and benefits, then we concluded that under certain conditions, social rental housing is overall a better investment, more return on that investment than RDP. Where are these extra economic benefits of social housing compared to RDP? Where did we find them? Our assessment showed that most of the benefits are in transport savings, was certainly highly significant, and to a certain extent, reduced crime levels, certainly within the social rental housing complex itself, certainly decreased crime, if not in a broader neighbourhood, certainly within the project itself, and somewhat improved educational and employment outcomes for the social rental. This came through so strongly time and time again. As a realtor will tell you, location, location, location. Where the housing was located, more than any other single factor, determined its success, determined how good this investment was for society, more than any other factor. More important as to the typology of the housing, whether it was RDP or social rental, is where it was built, more than anything else. More findings. Well, I've just said this. Considering financial and economic costs, social rental housing is a significantly better investment when RDP is peripherally located, which it usually is. There are certainly exceptions and to gateway, but on the whole, RDP is peripherally located. However, when RDP and social rental projects are situated in a similar location in the city, the differences for society is less, and the extra investment of social rental are not necessarily compensated by its advantages. So when you have them both in better locations, the great advantages of social rental are not so strong. From the perspective of public finance, it is critical to note that RDP housing creates a substantial life cycle burden cost to municipalities. This is often unseen. I don't know how much Treasury even recognises this, but our research showed it very, very clearly, and many of the municipalities know this themselves. While social rental does not create a municipal financial burden because it passes it on to the social housing institution and therefore the tenants, there is a significant initial and ongoing burden to municipalities related to RDP housing. Third point, RDP housing requires a greater total lifestyle subsidy of the residents. While there's a smaller, as we mentioned earlier, while there's a smaller initial direct subsidy than social housing, over the life cycle, there is a much heavier ongoing subsidy for RDP residents as opposed to social rental. I guess philosophically, you can say that RDP is more redistributive, but social housing is the more fiscally sustainable over the long term, is what our results show. Social rental requires a sufficient income of the residents to pay for these lifestyle costs, while RDP involves a much higher indirect life cycle subsidy, the sorts of subsidies that are not called housing subsidies, but it's public money anyway. And therefore, it can cover a lower income group than social rental. Okay, what are the policy implications, very quickly? Now, I need to be absolutely clear. We are not here to run down the RDP program in any way, shape, or form. It's had its challenges, it's had its successes. We're not here to run it down, and we must state very clearly that the results of this study do not justify choosing one form or exclusively choosing one form of housing over the other. They do not do that because they generally target different income groups, although I might say some social housing institutions are doing very well in targeting lower income people. And they have different intended effects. There is nothing in our report which would even remotely suggest we need to wind down the RDP at all. From a policy design perspective, the financial, economic, and fiscal consequences of social rental housing are related to the incentive structures created in each of the housing programs. I have to be a bit careful here, but incentive structures largely relate to what some researchers in the field call civic discipline. Social housing institutions, by and large, are meeting their obligations, their utility charges, their municipal charges. Municipalities are able to leverage against RDP housing is very, very low. What they can collect in municipal charges is extremely low, in some cases a statistical zero. Projects can be optimized using the insights in the specific financial and economic costs caused by the project. And lastly, we would say that with regard to the policy lessons learned, choosing a favorable location for RDP and investing in better security could minimize some of these differences, at least some of the differences. Location and better security. And thereby combining a positive outcome for society as a whole at the same time as providing housing for the poorest of the poor. These are just a few of the policy implications that we've pulled out of the study. Further research. Now, as you will see on your disk, this is a huge document. It's a huge unwieldy document. I don't know if even Mr. Stain's going to read the whole thing, and he likes reading. So, what we would like this read as many people as possible: policymakers, provincial departments, people, many stakeholders in the field. And yet, you give people a huge academic document. It's going to be tough to get through. So what we've done now is we have chosen what we see as four of the most critical issues to come out of the CBA, and we are in the process of developing four policy papers. We like to call them think pieces. We didn't want to say sort of policy position papers because we're not saying this is the position and you must stick by it. These four papers will be readable, and will hopefully stimulate further discussion, and we're going to launch them along with the official launch of the CBA in mid-September. What were these four issues? One, location and density. As I mentioned, location was such a critical issue in this, and also the importance of density, of medium density to high density. Although in one sense location and density in housing are separate issues, they're also very, very strongly linked. Our second paper is going to be on public fiscal issues, and I think perhaps the most important piece here being that of being that of local government. So I'm a bit ahead of myself here. Yeah, the critical finding was that the CBA was that the local government ends up carrying a long-term burden, cost burden associated with RDP. In effect, this amounts to an unfunded mandate for municipalities for a product over which they don't have much control. So this paper will address the key findings on public finance, with particular emphasis on municipal finance, but will certainly very much look at the national sphere of finances as well. We're going to tease out those issues. Developing social indicators for housing research. The CBA showed that outcomes in RDC and social rental were primarily related to location and household income rather than household typology. But the question remains for us in housing research, how do we develop appropriate social indicators to really understand the social impact of a housing measure? Health, education, safety, what are the things that are going to, in future, help us measure the social impact of various housing interventions? There's plenty of information in the international literature on this, but we really need to think about this in South African terms, our South African conditions, particularly the growth of our cities, the disparity of our income, all these factors. So this paper is going to start look at, it's going to really start looking at, in the South African context, how can we develop the best possible social indicators for us to understand the real impact, the real social impact of a housing intervention? And the last paper, the last think piece paper that we're doing arising from the CBA, is the discussion of housing as a social or public asset. There is a sense, perhaps in Treasury, perhaps elsewhere too, a general sense that investment in RDP may be preferable to an investment in social rental because RDP is seen as transferring an asset to a poor household while social rental doesn't. However, the CBA casts some doubt on this concept. And some of the reasons for that are is that RDP houses are rarely treated as an asset by the recipient. I don't know if there are any cases of people being able to really leverage, say, loan finance against their RDP house. We also know that the cost of maintaining the RDP house is often very burdensome for the owner, and that typically that cost will ultimately fall to the state in one way or another, even if not directly. We also know that most of the RDP stock does not really fall within the scope of the commercial housing market. We also need to critically examine this paper. We'll look at the concept of social rental housing as a social or public asset. How do we define an asset for in regard to social rental housing? Are there some payoffs for society there as well. So this final paper will look at that. And these will all be launched in mid-September. Okay, that is the end of my presentation on the CBA, and I'll hand it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. You are welcome. One of the members that has joined us. And Mrs. Lavant, you are also welcome. Honorable members, time for questions. Honorable Jane, for now. Honorable Francis, in that session.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I think one obviously wants to thank the presenters for this. However, let me also just say right at the outset that I somewhat expected a little bit more in terms of the results. And perhaps it's in the final papers there, but I expected more in terms of cost benefit of the one against the other. And not just the very broad strokes that you've given us. Because I would venture to say that the broad strokes that you've given us for some of us that have been involved in Arden for some time now is I don't disagree with those results that you came up with, but it's still very broad. But very specific question, Chairperson. In light of you having performed this analysis and gathered the information over the last 12 months, don't you believe that certainly the current economic crisis that we're in would have skewed the information that you got from your survey? And that under normal circumstances that one would get perhaps somewhat different results? Then what I'm very interested in, Chairperson, is and mention has been made a number of times regarding the hidden cost in the RDP housing, which certainly is there, but where the presenters indicated it's to be borne by the municipality. And I'm referring here specifically to maintenance. I quite agree that the ongoing service charges is a bit of a problem for municipalities. But to my knowledge, there's not a single municipality that has taken responsibility for maintenance of RDPL. It's left entirely up to the beneficiary, the owner. Then again, towards the end, your deduction is that you're not sort of offsetting one against the other, which one can appreciate. And yet, you indicated in your initial opening remarks that the primary objective was to assess the most appropriate direction for government housing investment. So whilst that is your objective, at the end, you don't really put your cards on the table, so to speak.
Mm.
Just a few more, Chairperson. You also talk about, under the critical questions for the study, how do both models perform against this policy framework, which I think is very important, but which policy framework are you referring to? In other words, which policy framework did you measure it against? Just one or two short ones, Chairperson, if I may. I was quite interested, and I'm looking forward to reading the more detailed report about the financial costs of social rental housing being 2 to 2.5 times more expensive initially. And then once you take other considerations into consideration, that it's more or less, long term, it's the same almost as RDP housing. And I think there you specifically referred to the land costs, which is almost never taken into consideration when you look at RDP housing. But having said that, you also towards the end indicate that when RDP housing is better located, that some of the advantages of the social rental housing is offset. Now, I dare say that is exactly over the last couple of years that government is working towards. I mean, we're looking at better location, we're looking at higher density. So taking that into consideration, won't it then basically be 6 of 1 and 1/2 dozen of the other, because the advantage of the location for social rental housing
If we get it right in terms of better location for RTP housing, we'll then negate that advantage that social housing has. And from my point of view, there is a place for social housing. I firmly believe that. I think for now, Chairperson, that's all for myself.
This comes down which means to call the manager. Madam Chair, I just want to find out from the researchers, having looked at the present RDP houses, have they checked what are the reasons for this poor quality of the houses? Because to me, as a person goes around, if you check, for instance, you have to have a mixture of 3 bags of cement with 4 wheelbarrows of rosette. The contractor will take 1 bag so as to save. So that makes also the quality of the house to be at a lower level. The second issue is the inspection of those houses by the building inspector. Do they do their work before they issue the certificate? And on coming to the social housing institution, the researchers, when they talk about RDP houses, they can give us roughly the residence, they talk about 47,000, which goes up to 120,000. What amount do we talk about on the social housing rental houses? A quick, just to give us a breakdown of residence, so that one can have a better understanding. My last point with this social housing, rental housing, they also indicate that the subsidy or the amount of it is far higher than the average housing. Now, for this person of close was unemployed, who is going to bear that difference of that of the subsidy? Thank you.
Can you take another question? I'm going to respond to this because I've got
I will respond to a couple of those, but as some of them pertain to the technicalities of the research, I'll then pass on to Andreas. Firstly, Mr. Stain mentioned about the skewing of the results because of the economic crisis. My understanding was that data collection phase of the research before the analysis actually occurred really before the credit crunch in a more normal environment. The maintenance of homes by the municipality, a lot of the ongoing costs refer to everything from the extra garbage collection, the wear and tear of the garbage vehicles, a range of municipal services that have to be provided rather than necessarily the direct remediation of the RDP homes. All those extra services to poor people in that area that have to be provided that are not sufficiently compensated by other means. Cards on the table, you're right. You had me in a moral point there. I suppose where we're at with this is that we're absolutely clear that in its current form, social rental housing is not really an option for the very poor. We must have RDP, hopefully better managed and better built. That's not to say some social housing institutions haven't made some extraordinary efforts. Madula Moho in Johannesburg, Yeast, are managing to rent to households as low as 800,000 a month, which is extraordinary. But by and large... 800 rand to 1,000 rand. For social rental housing, most households would have at least in the 1,500. So we don't want to run down RDP because really, at the present time, it's really one of the very few options for the very poor. The issue on location and the advantage of location, it is absolutely true that if we were able to better locate RDP, some of these these differences would disappear. But this then relates to density. RDP does not lend itself well to higher density housing. RDP can't really lend itself to sort of sectional title type buildings. It can't be flats. Because of the nature of the tenure, social rental and rental generally will always lend itself much better to the economy of scale of density, to RDP. It can be done here and there. I've seen some reasonable examples of row housing of RDP where there is no common property. There are a few examples here in Cape Town, but by and large, it's not a tenure that lends itself well to medium and certainly not high density. The other questions that I'd like to are technical, and I'd like to pass on to Andreas if I may. Yours doesn't work.
What is it to respond to the one issue I think you raised about? I think what the study also shows is that the tenure issue in many ways is a red herring. That really the critical factor here is the location of the housing. So your point is exactly right and taken, that if we changed the topology of RDP housing and we built RDP housing in better locations, you would achieve many of the social and the economic benefits you're currently getting from social rental housing. The key thing to note, however, is there is a higher cost in the short to medium term to society to be able to deliver that. Because the moment you're building in better located areas, the cost of land goes up, the moment you increase the densities, your infrastructure requirements go up, and the quality of the build has to go up. So there are, you know, those are the kind of trade-offs one has to make. But I think what the study does show is that in certain locations, that additional cost, even though the social rental housing, all that topology may cost 2.5 times what the RDP units cost, the overall long-term economic benefits to society are substantially better. So it's about households, for example, I mean, the key trade-off is probably housing versus transportation. So in the household surveys we did, so what in fact happens is that households invest substantially more in housing where their transportation costs have been reduced, and it goes the other way around. So what RDP in effect forces households to do is invest more of their household income, up to half their household income, in transportation requirements. So, you know, so those are the kinds of things that we need to think about from a policy perspective. Whether it is rental or whether it's to purchase is a somewhat different debate. I mean, the argument we would say is at the moment you're going for a higher density option, you probably require some form of institutional management. Just quite simply to have individual household ownership is very difficult. We've seen it in places like in the cities around the country where sectional title schemes have performed incredibly poorly. They require active household engagement and management. They're very difficult to manage, even in middle-class neighborhoods, you know. So we have to think a bit more creatively about what are the solutions around that. And then I think the point that you raised around the maintenance issue is absolutely right. Municipalities are not maintaining RDP. And neither are households. And I think that's the key finding. And the consequences of the economic life of RDP units is probably on average around 20 years. Now, that is quite simply unacceptable. You know, housing, well-constructed housing should be around intergenerationally. You think 40, 50 years, absolute minimum, with a... Yeah, so it was like, you know, a 10 or 20-year major refurbishment or maintenance cycle. And that's, you know, if you go to the big inner city properties in the country, those buildings have been around for 60, 70, some of them 100 years. And that speaks to the quality of the build, but also to the annual ongoing maintenance program. So the life cycle costs of social rental housing are so much higher because those institutions are making significant provisions for ongoing maintenance. So, you know, looking at our numbers, the average is about 3,500 rand a year is the provision that per unit that a social housing institution will make towards maintenance. In RDP, you're lucky if it's 50 rand. You know, and I think that's the trade-off we have to kind of think about.
So the other honourable member asked a question about the reasons for poor quality in RDP, and also asked around the finances. It that didn't fall within the central scope of the study, but maybe
Eugene.
Okay. Eugene is in a position to answer.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Neil Down. Chair and honourable members. The honourable member spoke about what are the reasons for poor quality, and the study didn't really go into the reasons for poor quality, but actually looked at what the finances were. So when we compared an RDP project and a social housing project in the same area, we looked at what are the actual costs of delivering those units and what the long-term costs which can be calculated against that, the same for social housing. Again, with around the question about the inspection of houses and do they do their work, the study actually didn't go to that level. And perhaps is that something that the house is saying that we must look at, or somebody must look at, we'll notice as something as part of our research agenda. The next question was around the actual subsidies involved in RDP and social housing. In terms of RDP, the subsidies average from 55,000 up to 120,000, I think like you rightfully said. In terms of social housing, the current subsidy right now, there's two types of subsidies. There's the, what we call the institutional subsidy, which is exactly similar to the RDP subsidy of 55,000 to 120,000. And then we have a pilot of a new subsidy under the Social Housing Act called the Restructuring Capital Grant, and that is at 125,000. Now, the subsidy does not equal the cost of the unit. The cost of the unit for social housing is between 250,000 to 300,000 for a 40 square meter two bedroom unit. And it's very interesting to note that the institution must get the difference as loan. So whilst we provide a subsidy of 125,000, in order for them to make up the cost of, say, 250 to 300,000, then the institution must make up the difference themselves by loan. And the reason that we have this kind of subsidy is so that the more subsidy that we provide, the less reliance there is on loans, because loan services the rent. The rent services the loan. And if we provide a better subsidy, it means there's a less dependence on loans, which means that the rent can actually go down. So that's it. And on average, we provide the social housing subsidy covers around 35% of the total cost of a social housing unit.
There was one unanswered question by Mr. Stain, and he might tell me off if I don't answer it. So that was, we talked about doing this study within an agreed policy framework, and he asked, well, what policy framework do we mean? We were referring to largely the policy framework of breaking a new ground, and that is the restructuring of cities, not just the delivery of housing, but the policy framework, the spirit of BNG, which looks at overall restructuring of cities rather than just the housing delivery. So with this study, BNG was always sort of hanging in the background as an overarching guide.
It's very good that we are actually beginning to address this unfunded mandate for municipalities, and that it's actually getting into some sort of form, in a document. Because on the ground, nobody understands who is the National Housing Department or Human Settlements or who's the municipality or who's the province. You know, on the ground, you're there as the councillors, eyeball to eyeball with the residents. So I think it is terribly important. And we've got to remember also that when we start talking about maintenance, we do need to start having a realistic picture of what it is municipalities are actually now having to fork out and Although there are other things like equitable share and, you know, all those sort of things that also, you know, in addition to mix. I would just like to understand with the research that you've done, you talk about, I think, six municipalities, and I heard you mention 600 households, and obviously you've done a very in-depth, I like to believe, study on this whole thing. You know, is that the correct figure? And the length of time, I'm given to understand with an answer to a question there that this has been, this research has been going on for some time, as to how long that has taken you to do it. The other thing on the research, are you also comparing, and I know we're talking about a typically South African situation, but are we also comparing it with another country in similar situations in the research that we're producing? And the other thing I need to know, since you have this research, are we able to go on the internet straight away and access that? I'm not sure if we're all getting one of those today.
Yeah.
Oh, we are, so we don't have to worry about it. Okay, well, that's good. And then I want to also just, you know, in rental stocks, what asset does that, I don't understand how that's an asset when an RDP house is a starter house, really, in a sense. And people can add on to that as their finances improve, and they then obviously do get a better asset. I don't understand about rental being an asset. To me, rental is a... you get nothing out. You pay, but at the end of the day, you don't get anything. I know you're talking about the economic, the social, all of those things, but I really need to understand that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. From my side, there's this term among politicians that we must not build houses, but we must build communities. I just want to know what is the role of SHF in terms of that sphere or lack that usually there's a big absence. You'll find in the past our people has been dumped, sex has been raised up, they come to the very same place, and they build RDP houses without the necessary health facilities, soccer grounds, schools, etc. So there's a need to give some sort of image when one do a presentation like this, some image on the social indicator side. And then also in terms of integrated communities, I understand that the trade-off will be a lot, but one must also be honest in saying that the trade-off will be for the fat cats, etc. And I'm of the opinion that the people who must be the beneficiaries of these trade-offs must be the communities out there.
Myself, I mean, I was studying in housing type of a situation, therefore. I mean, a real question that I can answer. And but even the research, where that has been done, maybe I just raise one issue because I think in the research, you are almost making a very practical pronouncement on social housing. And of course, the cost benefit analysis is sure that they have to be actualized. At the point I just would have raised that the location in the city is very critical. The region, the RDP houses are located in Gilbert, Johannesburg, and they are in the new town of the Montana. But also, in a situation where ownership is more predominant, and then social housing can almost not dictate, you know, but at the same time we are arguing that people are not regarding the RDP as the other. And then there is a bit of problem there. And but also why I said that has to be also put in. We can change it into a high density area. I think there will be a lot of experience in other areas where it has to be, instead of tree standing alone, the areas, and then we can also have a four stories and make it work. But the point again, how do we compare in terms of social housing with the other mid-income countries? I don't think they will have up to see. I think it's all in this situation trying to address the issues. But just addressing that with the mid-income countries, how do we compare in terms of the social housing? Given the fact that there are more people who are migrating from rural to urban, who had no intention to own any property in urban areas, because they still had themselves there, they're so generous. They come there looking for jobs and then they go back to our area. Whether social housing is also influenced by that understanding. And the point that to me is very critical, because I think we've been saying we have distributed billions of rands from assets to our people. If the very same people who have invested these assets say they don't see them as assets, you know, and then there's a problem, bigger problem, then I think we should assist them to address. I think we can assist them on their comments and also hopefully. Once we have come to a final study that will assist us again to look at the policy matters, what is this really that we can do to address the current situation? Because I think other members are more informed than myself, I think, on broader housing issues and implementation. That's the level. The number of people who are homeless is increased. Despite the fact that we have almost delivered about 3.1 million RDP units throughout the country. I'm not sure that the number is correct. I think in the numbers around the area, I'm not sure if that's correct. But the number of people who are homeless against the but also the sustainability, because the point that you are not specifically addressing the sustainability of the RDP house, because it seems in the long term, they're not sustainable. Because I don't think the municipalities will have resources every time to address them. Therefore, they're going to be neglected and collapsed. In other areas, of course, because of the subsidies that we raise, sometimes the quality of these houses is set. I think many of us, and I think there was one problem in the TV about these houses, some of them were collapsed, some of them were 6 months old. And then maybe the cause of that, again, the question of subsidies, I don't know what it is. But I think you have conducted the research. If you can assist the policymaker to come to an informed decision, because I think the purpose of this research is to assist us at a certain point in time to come to an informed decision, whether we need a policy shift on some of our areas of emphasis or not, but to be based on real information that is made available. So I think that is the main purpose really, that we are trying to assist us to arrive at that situation. But other issues that just worries me, how do we combat with other mid-income countries to other ones? Are we fair? Are we worse off? And we are trying. Because really, 3.2 or 2.1 million houses within 15 years is a lot. I think it's unprecedented. But if the majority of people are in this house themselves, don't see them as the part of their asset. That they can go to financial institution and require some loans and using them as collateral. I'm not sure if there's anyone anywhere who has done that, but maybe in Alexander they have done that, I don't know. Who goes to the FMD and say, I've got this RDP house, I want to borrow it amount against it, build the house. If it doesn't happen like that, then we are facing a bigger problem. Because those assets anyway were handed over to people for that table. Economic activities, that's the one that I wanted to do.
I have two things to follow up and
thank you, Chairperson. There are just two issues, maybe three, that I want to raise. One is mention is made somewhere in the report about the crime levels somewhat decreasing with a higher density. Now, I must say, in my experience, particularly with the older type social housing, social rental housing,
That is in fact not the case. It's exactly the opposite. That the higher the density, the higher the levels of crime tends to be. Then secondly, what hasn't come through in this particular presentation, but maybe in the report, is more information on the actual social benefits. I think we once again just sort of gloss over it in terms of education, perhaps health, and I mean, reason would tell one that in a social housing project, perhaps the education and the health levels, amongst others, would be better, simply once again because of location. But it didn't come through what I expected, rather, a more sort of in-depth analysis on those implications, the social housing factors, compared to the two types of housing. And then lastly, Chairperson, and perhaps I'm being a bit biased here, but in some of the replies, mention was made of social housing that may have been built 30, 40 years ago, which is and the quality of it particularly, as compared to RDP housing of today. And I want to suggest that perhaps if the researchers had taken the N2 gateway social housing into consideration, that we would have had a more balanced picture in terms of quality and so on.
Yeah, I think my follow-up hasn't covered partially is that even in this motivation study of the researchers, they say National Advisory argued that as RDP units are less costly to develop. Now, that's why if you go more especially to my constituents in the Bulland, the way how these RDP houses have been developed in some areas, because they take that, they've got a piece of land already, and the next issue is to raise the funds to develop that house. And some of these houses are not dormitory houses, and you can't think that an RDP house. So I think we need to balance this research. We should go broader, to go not only to areas which is like Comas or Martin, go to much rural areas, and you see that there is a difference. And even coming to this field of crime, I agree with the gentleman that in those areas, the density is lower. The crime levels are lesser than the higher ones. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
We have a sort of a number of themes here. I think where possible, we'll try and answer those themes. Some of those themes are, how do we compare internationally? Rental housing stock being an asset, building sustainable communities. I will give a couple of answers and make comments before I pass to Andreas for the technical comments. Then I think I might pass to Eugene on the question of international, of how we compare in internationally. There was one other committee member here.
A couple of quick
general comments from me. One on assets. We have to emphasize that with notable exceptions, with some exceptions, by and large, RDP is not treated as an asset. To be able to use property as an asset, you can't be alienated from the economy. You have to have a bank account. You have to be participating in the economy. By and large, we've found that RDP, if anything, creates a burden for the household in its management. They're often spending 30, 40, even 50% in transport to get where they can reach economic opportunities. And then the inevitable costs in maintaining a household, particularly with the 40% of RDP, which is substandard, creates a significant burden. Now, when the systems start breaking down, the plumbing, the electrical wiring, forget it. That's an incredible burden. So rather than creating an asset, we've, in most cases, have created a burden. With our think piece paper on assets, we want to recast the thinking on assets and possibly introduce the possibility
that in investing in social rental, we are creating a not so much an individual household asset, but a broader public asset where we stabilize communities, integrate communities, and form a basis by which households can better their economic circumstances. So in that sense, we're sort of broadening the concept of an asset. The gentleman over here talked about density and location and the need to densify RDP. As I sort of alluded to before, you can only densify RDP so much. I've seen some very small plots and row housing. When you start looking at common property, if you're going to build two stories, three stories or more, then you are basically getting into the legal area of sectional title and levies, monthly levies. Now, the average RDP household is in no financial position whatsoever to come up with a monthly levy payment and to operate a sectional title, particularly where there is system breakdown, where there will be the inevitable major capital improvement needed 5, 6, or 7 years down the line. And I would be terrified to start forming what are effectively RDP sectional titles, to have them fall flat, if not within 1 year, certainly within a few years when the huge capital costs arise. I would be terrified in doing that. So the emphasis here is that you can only go so far with the densification of RDP housing. I will pass on to Andreas, the honourable lady who was the first, wanted exact figures and exact timeframes. Are you doing it? Okay. So Andreas, can you?
Before I explain some of the other issues, just very quickly on the last point I think I want to make is that from an economic perspective, a household can only be an asset if you have a market in which you can trade that household. So banks will only lend money if that asset is worth something in the market. Now you've got two problems. You've got a lot of these RDP settlements are too peripheral so that an existing formal housing market doesn't consider them. And then quite simply, you have a legislative condition where households who acquire an RDP unit are restricted from selling that unit for a period of time. So you have an impediment there to the creation of a market. And as long as you don't have a market which values that asset, it's extremely difficult to leverage anything off that particular property. And to add that, which we'll put in our discussion paper, there is, however, the issue of housing as an economic asset in a different sense. And that is quite an important thing we must note, and that a lot of people are using their RDP house as a means to generate income. So, for example, there is significant economic activity around the rental of rooms, rental of shacks on the RDP property. So there's a rental income stream to that household. Or there are spas or shops, small, you know, backyard manufacturing. So in fact, that property offers them a place to conduct economic activity. So there is that benefit. So I think we have to be balanced and not just say, you know, so it may not be an asset in the sense of being able to leverage bank finance, but it is providing a range of other opportunities which are not necessarily there when you go into medium or high density housing, and for example, in a city context. You know, so, I mean, I always cite this example that, you know, I think Johannesburg Housing Company wouldn't be happy with people keeping chickens on the 8th floor of their building. You know, so there are some trade-offs we have to bear in mind. Very briefly, I think there was some question around the economic and the social benefits. I mean, we didn't cover it in the presentation, it is in the report, and I think there's quite a lot of detail in there where we looked at primarily education, healthcare, access to economic opportunity, and crime. And all of those cases, there are significant differences depending on where the locations of the housing project. And by and large, social rental housing households are better off because they are more proximate to a greater choice and better quality education and education, healthcare, as well as job opportunities. There is a bit of a concern in the study. We've noted it as one of the things to bear in mind, that to some extent that's also a reflection of income levels, however. Because by and large, households in social rental housing have higher income levels, so they tend to have like higher levels of education. But we did test, for example, what happened to households that moved into new housing projects from previous areas. And in almost all cases, those who did move into a social rental housing project managed to improve their circumstances. So I think that's very important. On the crime issue, that is a bit of a mixed result, and your point is taken that in fact, most cases where people move into social rental housing, the crime in the broader area increased. But the crime within the complex decreased. So there was a greater degree of personal or household safety, but there was less safety in terms of walking on the street or going outside of your household. And that's kind of in line with very much international research, which suggests a bit of a continuum that in very broadly, sort of highly dense areas, you have high levels of crime. It tends to decrease as density increases. But by the time you get to very sparsely populated areas, in fact, crime increases again. So it's sort of an interesting, you know, balancing act which we have to try and negotiate. But I think, you know, your point is taken. So I think on all of those, you know, the economic effects are noted in the report. And what we've actually done in the CBA model is really to try and quantify the cost of these to society. So for example, in education, if households are able to access schools, and it's not just a question of better schools close by, but it's the fact that you're reducing travel time. So it makes it more affordable to send your children to school, which results in children being in school for more years, which improves their chances of getting employment, which reduces the requirements of the state to fund those households. So there are all of those economic effects, which we have tried in our model. I mean, it's very complicated to try and quantify, because those are outcomes for societal welfare. And I think that is what we're trying to shift here, to say that this is more than just a shelter over your head, and it speaks to the policy to say that surely what we're trying to do with housing is restructure apartheid space. I mean, if we're not trying to do that, then what are we trying to do? And that means, and I think there was a comment earlier about all the social amenities. That's exactly the point. That just, we don't start thinking about the costs and the benefits around where we locate housing, and including all of the social amenities required for true sustainable human settlement, then I think we're not kind of doing what we need to be doing as policymakers. So I think it's all in the report, and I think by and large you'll see that it's the locational issue that makes a huge difference, and it does improve people's quality of life and livelihood, chances and opportunities.
The exact figures that
I think the more on those issues. And on the issue of maintenance, give up the housing by the beneficiary. We know that even maintaining for this home is expensive. And our people, in terms of credit, some of them are not afford to the credit, or some of them, they would like to be exposed, but they have no means. So I think those are the issues that we need to look at them when we are discussing this. And the presenter raised the issue of the sectional title scheme as opposed to the article. So I didn't understand, I didn't catch it after that issue. But I think we are still going to take this discussion forward. I think as a portfolio committee, we need to engage on this discussion further. But I'm going to give in Diane, Water, who else? And then after that, the department is going to head the bike after the response from the presenter.
Thank you, Chair. My comment is on this issue of asset or not asset. I think the BNG policy was an attempt at creating an asset for the low income people. At least that's my understanding. And in so doing, it advocated a policy of integrated human settlement, where the facilities that are referred to, closeness to schools, shopping centers, health facilities, and so forth, would be built in that community where human settlements are being developed. Now, I'm not hearing what the research says about the benefits versus the distance from the city center of building an integrated human settlement. Because the idea of a human settlement is the same as saying you can't move Soweto from where Soweto is, but you've got to bring facilities to Soweto and make that a segment of the city. That's one. Two, I would like to a degree challenge this notion that RDP are not an asset or may not be an asset, because the approach of the RDP, much as the criticism of the RDP, of course, is that some of the houses are very small, quality poor, and so forth. But if you take the old township houses, the forum houses, which were first built as half a loaf, two rooms, and then later on incrementally extended upon, those houses, some of them were no better than these RDP houses in terms of the quality. Maybe size, they were different. I just want to make the example. I recently improved my mother's house in Port Elizabeth. And I thought I was extending the house. But when I dug the foundation, I realized there was no match between what I was going to add and the foundation. It was this, what was called the foundation. And I had to dig 600 millimeters down to build my new foundation. And but if you look at those houses today, their prices, they are actually selling, and selling between 200,000 to 400,000, depending whether it's extended or not. And there is a market for that. There are estate agents all over the township. So if the criteria is determining whether there is a market to decide whether it's got an asset value or not, there is a market in this area. So the question of location It's for me, I think we need to rediscuss this issue very carefully. I'm not really convinced about that argument. Quality, yes, I am convinced that, of course, people are reluctant to buy something that is falling apart from day one. But if the quality of the RVP was improved, of an RVP house was improved, obviously there would be a market for that. Now, the last point I want to comment on is again, if you say for the asset to have value, economic value, it's got to be, you've got to take into account the transport costs and so forth, which I agree with, but that there is a trade-off between bringing the house or the poor closer to the city center. Now, if I use the ridiculous example, if you bring RDP houses to Sandton, or closer to Sandton, your rates in Sandton are higher than in Dipsworth. So what you think you are saving in cost, you are going to have to pay out in the form of rates and taxes. So that has got to be taken into account as well. So I would like us to really look more carefully on some of these.
Eugene, do you want to?
Yeah. Thanks, Chair. And may I suggest that if we are not able to cover any questions verbally, that if we can have a transcript of the proceedings, we will respond to it in writing. I think one of the questions was asked for confirmation of the breadth of the study. And I'm confirming that we used 3 municipalities and 6 projects. So we had to choose municipalities in which there was an RDP project and a social housing project in close proximity to each other. And that's quite difficult. Because, you may get good RDP houses, well located, but not, and there wouldn't be a social housing project near to that. Hence, the ones we chose had that kind of element. It was where an RDP project and a social housing project were in close proximity to each other. The other thing was, how many households did we interview? Yes, we interviewed 600 households in both the RDP and the social housing units combined. So it's 600 households across the board. The research was conducted between June and November 2008. The question on crime, I think within the units, what we are seeing, within the social housing units, what we are seeing is greater social responsibility and civic discipline. And that's a big issue, I think, for us going forward. Around the question of internationally, the gentleman who commented on this is quite correct. South Africa is unique in the fact that it provided ownership units to the poorest of the poor in a relatively short space of time, it's never been done anywhere else like that in the world. In a country like Europe, which after the Second World War had buildings that were demolished, the easiest product to put on the ground was social housing. So to a large extent, all of Europe, what you will see as the public investment is social housing. They invested heavily in it for at least 20 to 50 years, and then after that the level of investment declined. They've even now moved in some countries to what we're calling a subject subsidy. So the subsidy does not go to the unit, the subsidy goes to an individual. So that's something we could possibly look forward to. And the way we compare, I think, yes, the kind of sentiment that the public has is that having an RDP unit is a more preferable option because you get ownership of the unit. But in the rest of the world, the view is that the investment is considered a public investment if the public at large owns it. So it's not just about the investment where an individual takes ownership. That can be regarded as an asset, because that becomes an asset owned by the individual. But a public asset is something which the public owns for a period of time and from which the public at large derives benefit. So that's what we have in common with the rest of the world. South Africa at the moment, we have in the region of about 50,000 units spread throughout the country. In countries like the Netherlands, you've got over 250,000 units, and that's huge. You have one single institution in the Netherlands that manages 90,000 units. That's quite substantial. We are planning at some point, through my principal, to maybe look at some kind of exposure for the scheme as well. In terms of how do we attract the best contractors, there are minimum standards for social housing. There is a large degree of oversight in terms of the development of these units from construction to the time of occupation and post-occupation. The reason that there is such oversight is because social housing doesn't stop when a person moves into the unit. That stock, in terms of the Act, must stay social housing stock for at least 15 years. Therefore, it's important that post-construction or post-occupation, there's oversight as well. We are able to get good contractors because we also have oversight into the social housing institution procurement processes. So we ensure that the best people that subscribe to the best quality are appointed as contractors. I think your point around public education and community empowerment, Chair, is critical. I think strategically one of the reasons why we embarked on this process is to sell the concept of social housing in this country. You will know that with the credit crunch, many people now are not able to get home loans. You will also know that many people are progressing out of the income bracket of 3,500 to qualify for RPP. And at currently, even people earning 10,000 rand are not able to attract bonds. They're looking at joint income of at least 12,000 rand. So there is clearly a gap where people can qualify for RGC houses and where people can access bonds, and we are clearly trying to address that. I think the question of whether it's an asset or not an asset is open for debate, and I'm sure that your further discussions will spark off many issues for us to delve deeper into. I am aware that the old stock, as we traditionally knew it from the old House of Delegates, House of Representatives, House of Assemblies, which eventually translated into 99-year leases and then became ownership units, they've got value over the years and they've become much sought after within the communities. But the fact is that we are not seeing that for RGC stock, and as we know it now. And I think your point on what will happen if we take RGP to a better location in terms of the rates is certainly a factor that must be calculated. Again, let me say, Che, that we restricted this study to broad-based information that we had on rates from all of the municipalities, but it was restricted to 6 projects, 3 RGP and 3 social housing. We fully accepted that from this forum today, perhaps there will be a clear a charge that we have to broaden this research and deepen it as well.
I think it's a fascinating comment. Although I didn't get the personal title thing and the
personal title. Sorry, Chair. I think the point that we were trying to make is that where you had, for example, old council flats, when you try to move that into ownership, the only way to do that is via sectional title. And it's not an easy process, and it has to be with joint participation with all of the people involved. And what we found is that the ones where it has been attempted, you have extremes. You have fairly good examples, for example, in KZN, and you have not so good examples in Gauteng, where they're trying to pioneer exactly the same thing. So ultimately, where you have people staying in these older flats, They don't want it to remain rental. They want it to become ownership. And the only way to do that is via sectional title. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Although I've made almost written notes on 5 pages, I will try to be as short as possible so that I don't attract further questions. I will preface my comments generally by like what the satisfaction to me, acknowledging that I will not be responding to, acknowledging that in general in the delivery of housing as we have discussed before, and I made this question, the reference to housing in this particular case for a reason, has had its good, bad, and the ugly side in terms of delivery. And in that regard, I will seek not to even defend the ugly part, but certainly acknowledge that there has been good. I think this is a research that effectively tells us a number of things. Like researchers do, they tell you some comfortable things and some uncomfortable things. Then they tell you those that you palatable and unpalatable, and then leave you with some imponderable in the program. For example, it makes the choice, I think, in the slides that were hidden or the ones that were not distributed, a profound statement about some of the things we didn't consider, and I think we need to acknowledge that in discussing the analysis between RDP and social housing, and I think it makes the conclusion that it's not one or the other, but that there is a question of a proper decision-making process, which they don't deal with in the process, that should be used to make the choice at a location basis. And I have to indicate, as they may not be aware, we in the human settlement approach, we even avoid getting into a project being a social housing project only, but rather a project that is packaged to include every one of the instruments we have. And I think that is certainly an issue that I think we will deal with as the research teams are discussed, and we are coming out with of policy choices that we will need to advise policymakers like yourselves about. For example, it doesn't make considerations to political choices that have to be made, and political choices are real. They get made by people who have constituencies. For example, in the choice, in a country where there's been a long history of dispossession, one of the priorities that come out of that is reflected in manifestos of the past and today is the issue about empowerment of the poor as a priority and the rest in the country. And therefore, I think the choice of ownership as a tenure option for empowerment, asset creation, despite the bad and the ugly cases where that has been not achieved while intended to be achieved. The good thing about the research is that it is asking us to look at the real choices that we need to make, particularly now that we are looking at a broad human settlement development approach to building communities. In that regard, I think it's beginning to tell us, for an example, that what are the real investments that we need to make? I mean, we've been making without acknowledging them as government in totality, and not as one sphere of government there as against another sphere, sometimes competing for no reason in the process. But if we are delivering these assets, the real cost of doing so is X, and you can't assume that a municipality will absorb this cost without reaching a proper regime and an agreement, an arrangement with that municipality. And that, in fact, at the national level, we are already discussing that choice must now be acknowledged and made, and that the full cost of delivery is acknowledged. let alone the need to then coordinate better through the proper planning of the mandates to deliver the complete human settlement outcome. Interestingly enough, there are other social researchers who argue that in the disjuncture between demand and supply of and I make reference to housing, for example, perhaps let me say to of services in their totality, they argue some of them that you would need to package the delivery of these in a proper way so that you can spread your rent as wide as possible. I'm saying it's not one of those things that I necessarily agree with, but it is a consideration that we have to make in the process. That in some cases where people are living in totally unacceptable situations, as you would find the response in terms of the informal settlement upgrading program, you need to improve that, even if it's not to the full extent today, and you must create the certainty to those people today, not create an impression that you've never been dealing with them because you have to deliver the expensive units in terms of rent, which the research might not be looking at. I mean, it considers the totality of things, the reality is that there is an investment to be made today. And in that regard, I think that argument needs to be taken into account, and it is critical for policymakers. it does indicate some of the critical benefits, and maybe I think as comments have indicated, it doesn't cover some of the social benefits in the presentation. I'm not sure in the big document, because this is a summary. There's quite a lot of social benefits for both rental social, particularly I think in social rental housing, we are arguing because I think the research does seem to simplify this thing of location as if it itself is the BNN or the reality, even with location. Is that the research comes after the effect. Generally, it is correct to find to have you would have gone and found that. Generally, most of the social rental housing programs are well located. That's not because the reality is that why, and there are the considerations that we live in the process, and I think we need to make those choices. They have been because I suspect the tools for making the decision are better than the tools used for RDP housing. The opposite also applies. The numbers you get from social housing programs are pedestrian compared to the numbers you get for, and these are things of that we can't be oblivious to in responding to. But I think, Chair, the debate about the long term plan of the country space wise would start to tell us exactly where are the real benefits. Because it is true that while it is appears to be less costly to deliver an RDP housing as in the manner that we deal with today, it is not sustainable to spread our cities at the rate that we are doing, even recognizing that there is increasing urbanization. Even when we recognize that, it is not sustainable. I think those cost considerations relating to transport costs, etc., and some other social ills that are coming up with the are created by this. And in fact, I would argue long-term fruitless expenditure, disinvestment by government. Might be considered in society at large. And I think in that regard, the Chair, that is where you can argue for social housing, for medium density or even higher density to a point where it is not unhealthy, because we need to be very careful about densifying to a point ad infinitum. You must have proper norms that ensure that you densify it to a point where it does not counter the benefits that you get. And in that regard, I think social rental housing lends itself very well. The question policy-wise, and I think we will work with the team to come to find solutions. They are not there, but it doesn't mean that we should not look for them. Is the tenure option that is related to densification? Because the research would have proved that you tend to incur other problems. I mean, in the country we've got many of these cases that we can relate to. Because when you have all these high density units owned by people, and you do not have a proper institutional mechanism to manage, then it's a recipe for disaster. It doesn't mean I will disagree with the research, but it can be done. There is a lot of things that need to be looked at, including the mindset, etc. Certainly, one argues that if it has not been that successful in the higher end of the income, how much worse will it be for people who are not earning income? One of the things that I think we leave in the process is that any rental housing program sustainability is determined by the extent to which income levels exist in a country. So in this regard, the most successful ones you would find Europe, Western Europe, maybe largely. That's also a factor of the employment level, as well as a social support network in terms of income that can guarantee the sustainability of the rental. Because in your rental formula, you have to factor in the cost of running the unit. If you are a careful financial manager, that would include maintenance costs, repayment costs if you bought it with capital that you borrowed from somebody else. It would also have to factor in a replacement cost based on your estimate of how long the asset is going to last you, because unless you say after 60 years you do not want to see it, then you can make the choice that you will not start to invest for replacement. And that is the formula I would understand for a successful rental program. So in that regard, Chair, those are the difficulties. We have poor people who do not have income. That is a reality, which argues that in the foreseeable future, we are not going to do away. It's not RDP, as in the projects that have been identified, a better assets. The fact that we've delivered poor assets is not a factor of the policy itself. It is because practitioners have done something else for which they should be accountable from time to time. Chair, I have avoided getting to those issues that are quality issues, allowing space for a proper discussion with regard to that. But it's safe to say that as the chair might have seen in the presentation that was made at MinMax, there is work that is being done. A simple an analysis of why in the government program, BNG program, we put a different regime for monitoring, for inspection, than is the case with the retail side. Because that's where the biggest problem lies, is when you then deal with our program, it's not all of the role players, even at local government, that play the role that they would play if they are building an expensive house, my house, your house. And we are arguing that that's where we need to tighten first, because if we don't deal with that, we are going to have that. It is impossible, nearly impossible, for the National Department to deploy sufficient inspectors on top of the inspection. Even the provinces, we have to accept now, they do not have that capacity. They don't get the numbers in terms of the money and the resources to get to have those people efficiently there. Therefore, the resources existing, which are used for the high income level,
by municipalities need to be used for this, including our own failure to some extent of NHBRC inspection. And in that regard, we can deal with it at that point, because we are coming up with a proper modeled, we're not trying to create anything new, modeled on the existing processes that are there for the upper end of the of delivery. I think I make those comments acknowledging that this research obviously is a research of researchers that include my department researchers. It therefore provides us the space to start to think about what is it that we would want as our society going forward. And I think I welcome, Chair, the fact that the portfolio committee has invited that we have this discussion. There are other pieces of research, for example, the confirmation of the pricing of the various aspects, and so that as we want to argue that we no longer want to cost job structure only and cost services separately, we've got to go with the full package and say, if these things are going to depend on somebody else doing to provide, then we're going to continue to have this disjuncture, the type of delivery that we are having today. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zaman. We have
anything to wrap up? Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think we are very grateful to have had your time and for you to reflect with us on this matter. And we are going to again forward the dates for when the research would be again presented or submitted to a wider audience, which also involves stakeholders. It looks like it could be on Monday, the 14th of September, but we'll confirm that in writing. And also, the think pieces papers would then be also launched there. I think, Chairperson, from our side, is that we really have to encourage the dialogue around human settlement, around the products that we have, which has been quiet and has been more accusatory in most instances, rather than trying to find solutions for what we could be able to sustain as a community. So clearly, we're very thankful that you gave us this opportunity to make this presentation to you. Thanks on behalf of our team.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members, and our guests and our meeting. And I think this has been a fruitful to the region and an eye-opener, and I think it's been a lot of work to be done. Thank you very much. You are welcome every day when you have something to do for the community. Because I think these issues that those were raised here today were the questions that the portfolio committee was also asking itself from time to time. But we understand that we cannot come with the answers on one day. We have to do a lot of work. Thank you very much.
Excuse me, I'm from PMG. I'm running a report in this meeting. Could I ask you guys to forward your PowerPoint presentation to us?
Or you could grab the...
I've got a copy, but we... Oh, yeah, actually, give me the flash drive, yeah. Make sure that... you're a consultant for the
Yeah, I'm a consultant.
Excuse me, would I be able to get a digital copy of your PowerPoint presentation?
And you are?
I'm Emil, I'm with PMG. Okay, great, thanks. Oh, sorry,